to episode 33 of Book Banter. As always, I'm your host, Alex Talander. This episode is brought to you by GoDaddy. GoDaddy has become the world's number one choice for domains, delivering the highest quality customer service. To receive 10% off any order not already discounted, enter the GoDaddy coupon code BANTER1. For .com domain names for just $7.49, enter the GoDaddy coupon code BANTER3. And for 20% off hosting plans, enter the GoDaddy coupon code BANTER20H. Book Banter is a paid affiliate of GoDaddy US. And in this episode, you'll hear an interview with best-selling author of The Passage, Justin Cronin, in the first Book Banter co-interview. I was invited to interview Justin Cronin with Kay Cloutman for the Sacramento Book Review at his recent reading at Books, Inc. in Berkeley. Justin Cronin began work on The Passage when he realized two things. One, he needed to make more money to support his family. And two, his then 9-year-old daughter informed him that the two books he'd published so far, The Summer Guest and Mary and O'Neill, were boring. So he challenged her to come up with an interesting story. And for 3 months in the afternoon, for an hour each day, while Cronin ran and his daughter learned to ride her bike, they came up with cool and interesting story ideas. The result, for the most part, was the almost 800-page epic, The Passage. In the style of Stephen King's The Stand, The Passage is the story of humanity's attempt to triumph over nature and mortality, and failing miserably. On an expedition into the deep jungles of Brazil, a group of scientists and mercenaries is attacked by some very unusual bats, killing some, infecting others with a hemorrhagic fever, but most importantly giving survivors a newly discovered virus that proves to be a useful cure for humanity. Under Project NOAH, death row inmates from around the country are rescued and brought to a secret government lab where they are injected with this virus and begin the planned transformation into super soldiers for the U.S. military. But these test subjects soon transform into something not human, with a strength and a hunger that cannot be controlled. Soon the virus breaks out of the lab and begins to run rampant through the country, turning the population into these powerful, hungry, superhuman vampires. Our main character and hero-to-be is a young girl named Amy, whose mother, a prostitute trying to support her daughter, leaves the girl at a nunnery, where Sister Lacey Antoinette Kudotu looks after her the best she can. She takes her to the zoo, but Amy begins to act strange, inciting the animals in the cages to rage and fear. It soon becomes clear that there is something very special about Amy, but then she is captured and kidnapped, taken to the lab and injected with a virus, only it doesn't affect her quite like it does the other test subjects. As the country begins to fall apart, more and more people come in contact with the virus, as cities fall and states follow next. Brad Wolgast is the man who works for Project NOAH and first kidnapped Amy, capturing her once more, escaping from the lab and hiding out in the forests of Oregon as the country continues to fall to the vampires. It is here that Cronin reveals an important tenet of the book, the importance of children and the relationship between a parent and a child. Wolgast is still dealing with the loss of his own child and seeks companionship with Amy. And then the book moves 92 years into the future, where the United States of America no longer exists. All that remain are pockets of humanity, eking out a sheltered life, fighting to survive from these vampires. A particular group, known as the Lost Colony, lives in a well-defended fortress in Southern California. They refer to the vampires as virals. At the heart of this regimented and protected colony is the sanctuary, where the children are kept, looked after, fed, and educated until the age of 9, when they are reintroduced to the horrible reality of this world. This is a story of survival, an exploration of the human consciousness and the extent of its abilities in extreme situations. Cronin has done thorough research, wanting to get all the details right with the study in weaponry, the science of viruses, and actually visiting each and every place mentioned in the book, as well as driving and plotting out the distances covered for accuracy. His characters are great in number, but are all strong and individual, believable people. And then there is little Amy, who is the key and crux to the whole story, as well as to the second and third books in the trilogy. As to whether Justin Cronin has satisfied the two reasons for writing The Passage, after entering into a bidding war among publishers, he received a considerably large advance, and the book has gone on to be a national bestseller, with a movie in development by Ridley Scott's company. And because his daughter has played such an important part in developing the story, she no doubt considers this an interesting book, though it will be some years before she will be allowed to read it. And now the interview with Justin Cronin.
First off, thanks so much for doing this.
Oh, my pleasure.
So, first question, when did writing begin for you, and when did you know you wanted to be a writer?
That's a good question. Sometime in high school, I started writing fiction because my sister did, and I was incredibly competitive with her, to be honest. And she was very good. She was a sort of naturally fluent writer. And I'd been a reader, sort of voracious reader as a kid, starting in middle school, really. Before that, not at all. But then a kid turned me on to science fiction, basically. And sort of juvenile science fiction of Robert Heinlein,
right.
Space Cadet. Have spacesuit real time. A lot of books that featured, adolescent, young adolescent male protagonists having, great adventures in the cosmos. So I sort of turned out to sci-fi at that age. And then in high school, they actually offered a class called Great Writing. So my senior year, I did that. And that was the same time I read John Cheever for the first time, actually, which kind of told me, the first time I read something, I was aware that language had a sort of special power all of its own, kind of irrespective of the material, almost.
Right.
And it had a sort of musical quality that was really appealing to me. I was sort of a failed musician as a kid, And I think that's sort of the on another star, there's a Justin who plays the piano professionally or something like that. And so that is a sort of untapping. So somewhere in high school I started doing it. But like most careers that have non-traditional pathways, meaning it's not like going to becoming a doctor and you go to med school and when it's all over you, if you survive it, you're a doctor. You just sort of, other things fall away, and maybe you have just enough success that you can justify continuing to do it, and that was sort of what happened to me. I mean, so I crossed the 80s, essentially, from when I graduated from college in 1984, and across the balance of the 80s, I got just enough encouragement
to keep
going, and at some point it just became something that I had to succeed at, or I would never be happy. Yeah.
Well,
okay.
You've written two great novels in the past, and in the passage, you continue with your prowess of artfully weaving the tales of the characters in your story.
Oh, don't you say lovely things.
How is the passage different from The Summer Guest and Mary and O'Neill?
Well, it's sort of overtly different in ways that would sort of be disingenuous of me not to sort of confess, which is that it's much more plot-driven,
Okay.
And that said, I did not want to write a novel that where the characters were just sort of baggage handlers for the plot, which I think is the trap that a lot of genre fiction and commercial fiction falls into, to be honest, and why a lot of it feels unsatisfying to me. The books that I've always loved are the ones that, and I sort of discovered this gradually, like sort of across my 30s, as I was sort of moving away from the short story with its emphasis on what you leave out towards the novel with its emphasis on what you put in. That the novels I loved the best were always the ones that had interesting and distinctive language and good characters and a really big and a plot that was just like you just had to know what was going to happen next. And there are many terrific novels like this that are extremely well regarded and yet they could be classified, they could be shelved in a bookstore as with the westerns or the war novels, Larry McMurtry's Lonesome Dove is a book that was sort of transforming because it's just an irresistible book and beautifully written, one that appeals to friends. And another book that kind of sort of pulled me in that direction was a novel by Sebastian Faulx called Birdsong, which was a huge bestseller actually back in the 90s. I don't know if people are still reading it. They should. It's a sort of melodrama in some ways. It's a love story and a war story, but it has one of the great sort of horrible conceits of a war novel that I've ever met. It's about the guys that dug the tunnels between the trenches, right? Trying to put explosive underneath the enemy's trench in the First World War. The worst job you ever heard of. Like, the fatality rate, 100%, right? So the guys who did this are automatically heroes. It's kind of, just because that. I mean, it was all suicide all the time. It's the Suicide Channel. And, so, that was what I decided to do is I wanted to write a book, in this sort of innocent ambition, that you have when you start a book. But I wanted to write a book that really did all these things. I mean, those were kind of my models for what it is I wanted to accomplish. So in a sense, it's sort of a progression from those earlier books that were focused on character and location, setting, and sort of emotional nuances of being a human being. And then I wanted to strap my characters to kind of a runaway train. So that was the element that I added.
So,
passages classed and shelved in the horror section in some bookstores.
Sure.
How do you feel about it being classed as a horror novel, or do you think of it that way at all?
I'm happy to see it being shelved with other horror novels, as long as it's shelved elsewhere too. You know, because I want people to be able to find it. And one of the things I want to do is I want to write a book that sort of operated in multiple genres. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's science fiction. It's coming of age novel. You know, it's David Copperfield the vampire. You know. I'm happy to have it shelved anywhere. The idea that horror is sort of low form, which occasionally you hear, is really not true. I mean, it's sort of our pedigree as a literary culture, but I mean American, sort of European literary culture,
right,
begins with ghost stories, with the macabre, begins with the gothic, the Legend of Sleepy Hollow, followed by Hawthorne. I mean, the grand theme of early American writing is the encounter with wildness and strangeness.
Of course, you got Poe then.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's a wonderful company to be in. To call it horror is fine. But I did again want to write a book that where somebody wouldn't say, "Oh, that's a horror novel. I don't want to read it." I wanted them to say, "Oh, that's science fiction. I do want to read it." Or, "That's a coming of age novel. I do want to read it." Or, "That's a novel about the American landscape. I do want to read it." So I wanted people to have a lot of different ways to attach to it.
So can you tell us a little bit about what real life personalities provide as a source for the characters in the story? Your daughter obviously played a great role in creating this story, so how will she play in with the next installment?
That's a class question. The first question is, what real life personalities go in the book, and the answer is like everybody that I ever met. Your training as a writer happens by writing, by reading, and by being a good observer of human behavior. You don't invent people. You
watch,
collage them. out of things you've observed, and a little bit of you is actually in every character.
Right.
If you create them right, your moral sensibility is at least operating in some location within the character's psychology. It just has to be, whether or not it's, to turn it on its head. I was just about to use a different word, but whether or not you're inverting it, it's fine. But nevertheless, your sense of morality, of human dignity, where it goes into the creation of every character. So, my wife, my daughter, my friends, my bosses, my colleagues, the people down the block, they all get shoveled in. And then, once in a while, your neighbor says to you, "Hey, man, put me in your book." And then just where you needed a walk-on character who would be torn into pieces. And so, there you go. There's a guy who's really pissed at me in Texas because he read the book. He's like, "Oh, man, this entire job was to be eviscerated." You use everything, use everybody. Obviously, my relationship with my daughter was kind of central to the book's fabrication initially, and it's one of the things the passage is it's a father-daughter novel, right? It's a father-daughter story, and model set then King Lear, if you kind of go high there, an apocalyptic play, really, a play about the sort of disruption of all meaningful human bonds and institutions. So she's in there. She's dispersed though among several characters as well. The character Alicia is sort of my daughter as badass, with flaming red hair.
You ready for that?
I don't know. She's 13 now. The answer to that one is unapologetically, I steal from people.
So how much research did you do for this, and how long did it take that first draft to get done?
The first draft was 2.5 years, something like that. And then I spent a year just straight up rewriting, although I tend to rewrite a lot as I go, too. So I don't do like a draft, and that took a certain number of time, and then another draft, that took a certain amount of time. So it's much more sort of choppy and hard to calculate. What was the first part of the question?
And then what sort of research?
Oh, research, yeah. Well, you do lots of different kinds. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's this sort of research of just trying to be, sort of awake and alive and pay attention to people. I view that as research. I wish I could deduct it on my income tax. a scene where somebody has a baby, that's because I've watched the baby be born. I'm going to make that one up, then, of course, there's sort of technical data that you need, because there's lots of things in the book that I didn't really know anything about.
All the radio stuff, you have the communication.
Stuff, wind turbines, how to steal a diesel locomotive. I mean, all the stuff about firearms. Guns, straight up, I hired a guy to go teach me everything there was to know about guns in Texas. That takes about long distance, you know, 200-300
right.
target, right, to the second book in the series. That I'm writing that, so my dentist, like, took me out. To the my dentist, yeah. He's got a lease on some land in West Texas, takes his big deer every year, so he's like, you know, he was all about it. He was really excited. He's like, let's close the office. The other thing I did is I traveled every mile of the book at least once. You know, by car, by foot. I went to every place in the book. The geography in the book is 100% authentic, right down to the distances, the amount of time it would take to walk it. You know, it's like it's all there. I had to change the names of a few towns just because their names were cumbersome in some way. Like everything anywhere near the Southern California desert is named Yucca something.
Yeah.
Right? So I had to move a prison. In Nevada, I had to pick up a prison and move it closer to the test range area where Yucca Mountain is located. But yet again, another Yucca. but the distances, the amount of time it would take, I decided I would just be really loyal to the actual geography of, in this case, principally the West.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, other places in the book that are important are places that I know pretty well. That I spent some time there, Memphis, Tennessee. I actually lived right near the zoo. I lived bordering the zoo. And for a year I taught at the University of Memphis and we could hear the monkeys. And that was like the dominant impression of that whole year was like these monkeys going crazy in their cages at night. And so hence, you know, the scene at the zoo. So
So I'm going to ask you this question and please don't kill me.
Okay.
This is an almost 800-page read. What would your survival tip be for people and for readers so that they don't end up tearing the pages and they're only up to you?
Well, why would they do that?
I know some people who would do that. We're in Berkeley.
Yeah, okay. Well, you know, I think one thing you can do with a book if it's too heavy to carry around is tear out the pages as you go. I have done that while traveling. I used to do that when I was, you know, during my wandering years, you know, the Eurail years as a young man. I would read books and tear out the pages as I went. So, sure. All right. It is a long book. It's good for killing mice if you have them. I sort of rejoice in its length, you know, like that's my, you know, my publisher knew from the get-go that it was going to be super long. I told them I had several publishers who were kind of competing for the chance to publish it, so I told them all straight up that it was going to be, you know, a very, very long book. I think there's a lot of evidence that people have, you know, as long as the story's good, you know, people have, there's a place for big books, and there actually is, there's been something of a resurgence in it. There's been a number of really fat titles. Elizabeth Fastabo is the historian. Instance of the Finger Post. Under the Dome makes this book look like, you know, you could read it in a long way. So there's plenty of really big books out there. Harry Potter did that too. Some of the Harry Potter books are huge. And odd enough, I think one of the things that's paved the way for this is the emergence of extremely good episodic television, which has sort of brought Dickens back, in a sense, you know, where people are willing to stay with the story for a really long time. I'm the last guy in the world to do this, but I'm now watching The Wire. I'm like through season 3, and I'm going to put an orange couch in my yard, like, any day now, and it's, you know, it's like reading a really long novel,
right.
And it sort of started with, I guess, The Sopranos was kind of like the thing that kicked in the door, and then, but writers basically took over television in some way, you know, in the last 15 years, and people now are living with a story for a really long time in the way that 19th century audiences lived with each chapter of the latest Dickens. And so I feel like that's part of, you know, a way in which, oddly enough, other media has contributed to the health of, in particular, the long novel.
Would you say there's a moral to the passage, or multiple morals?
Well, you know, you don't want to reduce it to anything quite so, you know, because it's sort of deadening, you know, it's a very complex story with a lot of different elements to it, and different people will see different things. I know that I had an idea in mind that was a guidepost for me. It doesn't have to be a guidepost for the reader reading the book, but I think it's sort of hard to look away from. It's sort of obvious in the book. And that is, in many ways, it's a book about children. In the novel, human beings attempt to create, you know, an artificial immortality, which is a disaster.
Right.
But the reason that it's a disaster, from a sort of ethical point of view, is that they have failed to notice that we're already immortal, and that's because we have children. Like, you know, the future that I will ever to see is the one my children will live in. When I became a parent, I became immortal, became part of a really long chain of human life. Mm-hmm. And to mortgage their future for my benefit is automatically a catastrophe. And you can enlarge this in lots of different ways, in sort of different areas, and say, oh, there's an environmental message here, there's a message about science, there's simply a message about taking care of the world in which you live. The sanctuary becomes kind of a model for the last human attempt at this, And so that was for me kind of the guidepost. It is a father-daughter novel, and it bases it's a man who needs a kid, finding a kid who needs a father, and that bond is a very cohesive bond that lasts 1,000 years. I mean, it's just kind of built into the beginning of the book. So
wonderful. I think you want to just ask number 9 because number 8 is going to be redundant.
Oh, okay. So Passage is first in the trilogy. How far along are you with the second book? Can you talk a little about it? And is it going to be as long?
Well, I don't think it's going to be quite as long, and I hope it isn't, just because physical stamina begins to play a role. It'll be however long I want it to be. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's what I'll say about it. This book was, the Passage, so the first volume of this was, it just sort of made a case for its own length, and you have to let a book do that. That said, I think the second book will end up being a little bit shorter, and I think the second and the third one both will. I wouldn't say we're halfway through the story, but we're approaching the halfway point by reaching the end of the first book. The way that the stories are structured for volumes 2 and 3, there's a kind of tighter chronology between the two of them. That's how I'm imagining it. The second book, I'm writing the second book now, I'm kind of well down the road with it. What I can tell you about each of the books is that I didn't want to write a trilogy per se. I wanted to write 3 books that would add up to a mega uber story, but I wanted each of the novels by itself to be sort of a strong novel. Trilogies tend to create a fake book in the middle, and it's just sort of there to get you from 1 to 3. And I wanted each of the books to have something that resets the terms, both in terms of plot and then also in terms of some of the narrative model, to keep me interested, so that I would be like, I never want to write the same book twice, so I didn't want it to be and then the next thing. I knew that I don't think it'd be good for the story, it wouldn't do justice to it. So each of the books actually spends a little bit of time at the beginning, in the same way the first book, back in year 0. You actually and see something that you either never saw or glanced. Usually something you glance out of the corner of your eye that you didn't know was as important as the first book or the preceding book made it out to be. That resets the terms for the sort of continuing project of my characters, who are, embarking upon the mission state of human rights, right? Yeah. So, but, it's not just, oh, here's what we thought, and then we'll go do it. It's like, here's what we thought, and it's not exactly correct, right? Based on something, some new element that actually brings fresh characters, geographies, all the sorts of things that a book needs to be a good book on its own.
So, I really respect how you came up with a different breed of vampires. Did you find it challenging to create a new adaptation of the concept of these characters?
Challenging in a really fun way. I mean, challenge makes it sound like it was work. It's not a gas to do it. I did this before. This all came about before the current vampire boom lit. We started this in, my daughter and I had our initial conversations in the fall of 2005, which was, if you brought up vampires, then people would have said, oh, like Buffy the Vampire. I mean, that was probably the most recent antecedent. Yeah. And then, we've had a, different incarnation since then. And the thing that I wanted to do, I grew up on my own, my vampire narratives and my own vampire melodramas, which Dark Shadows was the, you all don't remember Dark Shadows, but it was a vampire soap opera that was on 3:30 in the afternoon. It was a bad high school play, and it looks now, and it's very traditional gothic melodrama, which is generally what you get with this stuff, and which I consider, in some ways, the weakness of it, or at least the thing that doesn't conform to my taste. That said, it's great material, but I basically wanted to do vampires without magic, and for whatever reason, magic in a narrative seems to me to be kind of a free-for-all. Like,
right.
Once you introduce magic, like, kind of anything can happen.
Yeah, yeah.
And I actually like a sense of confinement in a narrative that things have to kind of be plausible, right?
Yeah.
You know, and magic, even if when writers try to establish rules for the local magic of a story, at the end of the day, it's an invitation to a thousand days,
yeah.
Ex machina. And I didn't want to do that. I wanted to write something tighter, because I felt like it gave my characters specific things to push against in the story. So I said, okay, well, back, you know, every mythology, every legend has some kind of origin in fact, that is, from my point of view, is sort of an inhabitant of the, you know, 21st century,
mm-hmm.
has, you know, based in reality, and the rules as we know it in biology and physics and,
mm-hmm.
you know, character and so on. So let's go back and find out what the real, where does all the vampire stuff came
right.
from, right? And, you know, in that case, I invented a disease that had the, that sort of turns your thymus back on, right?
Yeah.
And what I wanted to do with this was take all of the details of the vampire legend,
mm-hmm.
and give them a home within the framework I created, right? So all the magical stuff, given a sort of explicable
right.
mm-hmm.
manifestation,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
So, you know, for instance, you know, the idea of it, you know, you can defend yourself against a vampire with a cross, right? Which is, from any point of view, sort of magical thinking, right?
Yeah.
In a pre-industrial society, or as my characters live in, a post-industrial society, the best weapon for shooting something through the thymus, right, is going to be a crossbow,
right?
Right. So, you know, and you're not going to call it your crossbow, you're going to call it your cross, because why use two syllables when you can use just
mm-hmm.
one?
Yeah.
So my characters are running around trying to kill vampires with crosses, okay, right? And that's where it would all come from. The business with the mirrors, another thing that sort of violates physics as we know it. Everything reflects in a mirror,
right.
But mirrors would have a special effect. In this case, one of a sort of melancholy recognition, so that, which is, you know, one of my characters discovers this with a pan in a kitchen, that when the viral sees their reflection, they experience actually a very human response to aging. I've discovered as I've moved forward in years, where you look in the mirror and you go, what is happening to me? and what they do is they experience a moment of recognition, you know, sort of a glimmer of what has happened to them and a sort of memory of their own selves, in the same way that people who are ill will look at themselves in the mirror and say, oh, I don't look so good.
Right.
Yeah. Who is that person?
Right, yeah, right. And so all of the details I tried to give a place to, and it ended up being a lot of fun to do it, and then putting it on my own, things that I just found creepy in the animal kingdom, you know, so I wanted to make sure there were sort of biological analogs
right.
to everything, so that they move like birds or schools of fish or social organizations like bees. They make a clicking sound in the back of their throat,
mm-hmm.
which is like dolphin language, actually, I think is really what which in the same way that you hear animal languages and know it's not a language you could ever learn.
Right.
Yeah.
But you know it's a language.
Yeah.
Like, I can
yeah.
speak, I could learn any
yeah.
other human language, but I could never learn
dolphin.
Which,
of course, is what bats use, too.
Yeah. So I wanted to make sure that they had a sort of, there was some originality to it as well, but that also all the recipe for vampirism was obeyed.
Okay, I think that's a good one. You've mentioned that Stephen King is a monument in one of your interviews.
Mm-hmm.
Who else besides Stephen King do you look up to in the literary world?
Oh, you know, there's so many, really. I mean, my tastes are all over the map. And I think you can find something of value in really anybody who writes, you know, successfully within the genre or just as a literary writer. I think I'm influenced by any good writing I encounter, you know, and in the last few years I've run across many books that I thought were splendidly written, even if they were, you know, books with almost no plot in them, you know, like Netherland by Jess Fonio, the novel I just love. It really captures the texture of male midlife, for instance. John Cheever was a very important writer to me as a kid, and then as a young writer, right? I mean, I sort of cut my teeth, and I read him from first time in high school, and then all through graduate school, was a major influence. I read sort of very deeply within sort of like the books that writers should all read, you know, things like Dickens and Tolstoy and all those things, you know,
yeah.
which teach you an enormous amount about, you know, story structure and how to make a plot. So these were all important influences for me. I mentioned Larry McMurtry's Lonesome Dove. That was a book that really opened my eyes,
mm-hmm.
I think.
Another long book, too.
Another really long book, you know. So, and then I think I drew some inspiration, too, from these wonderful books I read as a kid. The one I've mentioned a number of times in connection with the passage, because there's a little homage to it actually in the story,
mm-hmm.
is a book called Earth Abides by George Stewart, which
mm-hmm.
is this really great post-apocalyptic novel written in 1948 that it hasn't aged a day, except in some of its sort of, you know, the sexual politics, the sort of domestic politics of it. It's a little bit Lucy and Ricky, but it's, it sort of describes a very stately exit by the human race from the planet Earth, and then a small group of survivors who build a new civilization on the ruins of the old. And I still have my little mass market paperback from my sixth grade or seventh grade signature in it. That was really important book for me. So it's kind of everything, you know. I mean, if you read the book, you know that it makes references to so many different books. Everything, you know, Melville, Shakespeare, Homer, you know, zombie movies. I mean, you know, the Planet of the Apes. It's all in there, you know, and, you know, all the stuff that I've ever really loved and had an effect on me. So.
Okay, well, thanks, Josh.
And that was an interview between Kay Kloutman and myself and Justin Cronin, author of The Passage. And that about wraps up this episode of Book Banter. Thank you very much for joining me. In the next episode, there will be a selection of book reviews, as I will be going on vacation in the next couple of weeks and going to Europe. But as soon as I get back, the regular schedule of interviewing authors will continue. In the meantime, head on over to bookbanter.net for more book reviews and the Book Banter blog, and stay tuned for future episodes of Book Banter. Once again, thanks for joining me. See you next time.